Hi, everybody. This is Kev O'Donoghue, licensed mental health counselor.
And I'm Nasima Diane Deemer, licensed massage therapist and trauma specialist.
And you're listening to The Positive Mind, where we try to bring you some ideas, concepts, and guests. Try and help you lead a more positively minded life. Welcome back. I almost feel like lowering my voice and really slowing down today, because we're going to be talking about a very difficult topic. What can you say? I mean, grief and death, these are five-letter words. We know the four-letter words you can't say, but the five-letter words. And it's hard to... We have to slow down when we talk about these things. And sometimes really have to slow down just to feel things.
Yeah.
Our world can speed us up so much. You know, our world, you know how fast a computer works, you know? Mm-hmm. Some people like to try and be as fast as a computer. And we're on these devices all day long, and it kind of speeds us up a bit. And we're going to talk today about, you know, what's going on in the world from a mental health perspective, from a emotional perspective.
And a physical perspective.
And a physical, in many ways, all facets of being human perspective, talking about grief and talk about death. I mean, it's kind of hard to talk about death on the radio.
Yeah, you're a little afraid of turning people off, but I believe we are in a time when we can't help but talk about it. It's kind of everywhere.
And it is everywhere. And
more than we would like to see.
And at The Positive Mind, yeah, we try not to hide from things. We want to bring things out.
Yeah.
You know, and since it's here and since everybody is aware of it, I mean, mm-hmm, how often in your life have you been aware of these numbers, this death, this pandemic, and yeah, this grief than now? When else in your life? You know, Nasima, in preparing for the show, you know, I thought we all need to learn how to grieve well. You know, you don't hear a lot about that, grieving well. There's a lot of grieving poorly out, mm-hmm, there, mm-hmm, where you can grieve in little chunks and little bits and pieces, and grief can hang on to you for years,
yeah,
and years. And years. And on some level, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, you lose somebody you love. I mean, how many years, how many centuries does it take to get over that? We don't want to minimize that. But there's an art to grieving well. But before we say anything, I did want to, a thought that came to me was, you know, grief means that you loved. You know, if you don't love anything or anybody in life, in this world, you might not need to grieve at all. So we want to grieve well and help people, and we're going to be demonstrating today maybe a way to help you grieve a little bit better. But it says something that, you know, if you're in immense grief, maybe you were in immense love, and that's a good thing. And that's okay to talk about on the radio. So we wanted to talk, yes, about these difficult things on the radio because, you know, they might point to actually really positive things.
Absolutely. I think what we might be looking at, especially in this country, because we're not a country that has experienced this scale of death before,
yeah,
or at least in a very long time. And there's, I think, always like a global perception of the United States as being kind of, you know, young in its sort of evolutionary, mm-hmm, stage,
the historically perspective, yeah,
and that we're getting a dose of some real strong reality here. I know that there are people in other countries who've struggled through, you know, thousands and thousands of people dying in drought and in floods and all these things, like,
yeah,
there's a little more perspective on it that I think we're getting a dose of that perspective.
Yes.
And we don't, you know, why we don't grieve well is because we don't know how to grieve. We haven't really been through it in this way. And I think a lot of people in this country, there is such a distancing to death and our mortality. And we really try to look for what's alive, what's young, what's youthful, what's happy. We're like, our tendency is to look that way.
Yes.
And now we're being forced to look the other way and to see no, we are mortal beings. We will age. We will get sick. We will die. The people we love, this will happen. And we have to somehow live with both of these.
I like that a lot. It's kind of tough to, you know, try to find fault with your country at this time as it's going on. But, you know, if you look at all the TV commercials and everything that's being sold, we're being sold happiness all the time. And we're being sold, we're being sold youthfulness all the time.
Yes.
You know, so that is an aspect of our talk today, talking about grief and death, because, you know, we're not a country that, you know, celebrates death or acknowledges death or likes to feel about death. We're known as being an innovative, industrious country, creative and driven and hardworking and many, many things and all many, many great things.
Yeah.
But, you know, we're not really very agile in talking about, you know, the darker things of being human.
Right.
And so maybe it's a little awkward for me. Obviously, I'm having a tough time here today because, you know, I don't want to keep saying the word death. You know, I don't want to keep saying the word grief. And I want to tell our audience, you know, we're going to be using these terms today in preparation to be talking about some good things and talking about ways of dealing with this. And, you know, talking about ways of integrating this into your life. I mean, you know, when 9/11 happened in this country, you know, some people got to the phones, you know, everybody got to the phones, like, you know, everybody, you know, was calling who's there, calling people in New York, calling people in the towers, tower people calling people out.
Right.
And I was in a workshop once and somebody said to me, you know, if you had 7 minutes to live, who would you call?
Right.
7 minutes, who would you call? That kind of brings it real for you. Those are the people that you'd probably grieve over. You know, if you don't know if you'd have any people that you would grieve over and have really sad feelings about, who would you call if you had 7 minutes to live? So, so this is another instance like that, right? Where now it's going to take us time. Now we can take our time and digest what's going on, because it's not just happening to you. It's happening globally. It's happening countrywide. And it's a time to really think about. Another thing I thought about was, like, if you lose somebody now to the pandemic, and many of you have lost people and know people who have lost people, you know, it's sad to say, but they, you know, your grieving for them might be less than it would have been if they were sick, you know, if they got died kind of a month ago or 6 weeks or 2 months ago. You know, they're just a victim of the pandemic, and, you know, a lot of people died, so that person died, and it's sad and it's terrible and it's tragic. But it, you might not be feeling it as deeply as if they died 2 months ago. Notice that. Notice how you'll react to death, somebody's passing, in a different way. Just based on the circumstances. Here, it's almost like we're getting callous to the deaths that are going on around us. And maybe that's a defense mechanism. So we're going to talk a little bit about defense mechanisms today as well. And maybe that's a necessary defense mechanism because we have to protect ourselves and we're going forward, right? We still have to live our lives and be cautious and careful and not catch the pandemic ourselves. So we're in protective mode. We can't be in maybe in both modes at once, grief. So we're going to also be talking about delayed grief because maybe we can't grieve right yet.
I can imagine that a lot of people are in a state of shock or denial too. That these are, you know, it's a natural response. Like I believe there's a quality of shock around the globe. Because again, these numbers are so strong and they seem to come on so quickly. I think it, you know, hit China very quickly and the awareness of it. And we were aware of what was happening in China, but then It's like all of a sudden it's here. It's not going to come to us. Yeah, we kind of were in a little denial. It's not going to come here. We've stopped people traveling, but you know, guess what? It's actually been here for a long time. And we are, you know, kind of in a state of shock. It's like a tsunami hitting, you know, and that shock is going to numb you. That's what shock is for. Shock is a numbing agent in the body because things are just too much, and it helps you keep your mind in a safer place. But it's important to know and to not judge yourself if you are maybe not feeling this as much as it seems like other people are feeling it. That's just what you're doing right now.
You know, denial is the number one, top of the list defense mechanism. We've all heard the phrase, oh, he's in denial, right? You know, you're in denial. You're in denial, right?
Yeah.
People who don't know the formal definition of it really know what it means anyway, because often addicts, right? Alcoholics, people who are ruining their lives, people with addictions of all types, can be in denial. You can point to them all of the casualties of their behavior, everything that's falling apart because of their addiction, gambling addiction, any type of addiction. And the person, everybody can present them the facts, but they're in denial. You can't see it. And this is something that we human beings, we can do. The human mind is so powerful that it can go on and function and help your life function and you can go forward. But actually something totally different is going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think everybody is on a certain level of denial because, first of all, we're not all getting the same information. No, we're not. You know, you have to be in denial in some way. I can't let this consume me. I have to. How do you function going forward with the fear and the awesomeness of what's going on? Of course, you need a defense mechanism. You want to protect yourself against that. Denial makes the most sense. It's not going to get me. That's a denial.
Mm-hmm.
I am not. I'm different than everybody else. That's denial. I'm not susceptible. That's denial. I never get sick. That's denial. You know, there are levels of it. You can be totally consumed by a disease and still be in denial about it.
And the thing that I hold really strong about denial is that the person who is in denial does not have or feel the resources to be able to see what's really in front of them. They just can't do it.
Yes.
They just can't. And that could be because of past traumas or whatever, but there's just something that just can't see it.
So,
and that begs you to, as the observer from the outside who can plainly see it, because you're on the outside, you're not living it. You don't know all the constructs that are being questioned in accepting this. And so it takes a deep, deep compassion for someone who's in denial, that's where they're at. That's truth for them. It's validate that, because then they'll start to feel supported. And when somebody starts to feel supported and exactly where they're at, then maybe they can start to open up the blinders and start to see little by little what's real.
I love what you're saying. I mean, you know, who knew we were going to go this direction? But let's take a moment and think. Somebody in denial, what do they need the most? What do they need the most? They're obviously, they can't see reality the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
They can't. They're not able. Their mind isn't processing reality the way that reality is.
For them.
What do they need right away? What's the first thing? Because it can take years to unwind somebody's denial.
Yeah, I really believe validation is the first thing they need.
Say more. How do you validate somebody in denial?
Well, let's just take that example. If you say, you know, somebody's saying, I never get sick, so I won't get this. So you could say, you know, can you say more about that? We could use a little of the safe conversations technique that we've talked about in the past. You know, find out from them, like, what they're basing this truth on, this idea. And then, you know, either reflect it back to them. And then, you know, if I can say, well, you know, I've never gotten the flu vaccine. I've never gotten the flu. There's a certain level of trust.
My grandfather never got sick.
My grandfather never got sick. You know,
right.
All those things are, you know, I take really good care of myself. You know, all these things could be really true. And it could be true that maybe you won't get this. I mean, half of the people may not get it. Okay, so just to validate them, to say, well, it makes sense to me that you would think that. So, yes, so you've never gotten the flu before. You feel like maybe you won't get this one. And in a way that makes sense. It's better than fighting them with it, you know, and saying, but, you know, 50% of people are going to get it. How do you know? And you have to, you know, wash everything and like sort of like overloading them with this, these ideas. It's like, well, it makes sense to me. And in a way, it's like, let them have wherever they are. And that can start to sort of at least take away the tension of you thinking, no, you're wrong and I'm right. And you might be living right now in a situation with somebody who's like that. You know, maybe you're in a couple and one part of the couple is like, this, I'm not going to get this. I'm not worried about this. And the other part is like, I could very well get, you know, and I'm worried about getting it because I have these issues. Yeah.
Yes.
So, well, I'm worried about you getting it because you have these comorbidities. So there's, it's a real dilemma. But the thing about denial is it's very personal and it's really specific as to why they might be in denial. And it's really important to validate somebody in there, wherever they are.
And it's sometimes very obvious to people who aren't in the denial.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And but it brings up this principle that living in reality is the best way to go. That not living in an altered universe. Mm-hmm. You want all of the pleasures in life. I mean, you can have pleasures in being in denial. I mean, the alcoholic and addict can have their pleasures and deny reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, there's still pleasure in the denial way of living.
Yeah.
But really, a happy life, a productive good life, has to be lived in reality. You know, I mean, there's a sadness.
Yeah.
There's a sad aspect to witnessing people in denial, living in denial, spending years of their life outside of reality. And there has to be acknowledged. There's a sadness to that. There's an awareness. So how do you protect yourself from somebody who you want to help, who's living in denial, but also is not going to rub off and affect you? So that's another aspect. We're getting a little away from the topic, and
right.
I do want to...
And how I want to sort of bring it back is that, you know, this country has a quality of living in denial,
okay,
of mortality, of aging, of vulnerability, of fragility.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what we're getting a big dose of right now. And being, you know, being sort of confronted with grief and loss, loss of a way, loss of even that, sort of a loss of our denial, isn't going to happen to us.
It could be a transformative moment.
It could be a very transformative moment, and it could mean a real deepening of the sort of quality emotional life of Americans.
Yeah. So that's a perfect line to talk about, Nasima. What grief looks like, because, you know, there's a kind of courage to have grief, express grief, to live in grief in this country. You know, it's, if somebody's depressed in this country, it's like a real stigma. You're supposed to be producing. You're supposed to be out there fighting, competing, enjoying, you know, living it up. I mean, this is America. So there are many things that we're told subconsciously about how to live. And yet, you know, it's really an act of courage to let yourself grieve. So we wanted to talk a little bit today about what grief looks like. What does it feel like? You know, to me, grief is like 30 days of rain and not just a mild sprinkle. It's like a torrential rain. Although, you know, grief wanes and waxes. It comes in strong at times. It goes away. You know, it diminishes. But it's a gray day in your mind. It's gray and there's no sign of sunlight coming, you know, and there's nobody giving you a forecast of when it's going to clear. And at least 30 days, you know, technically, you know, in the mental health field, we say if somebody is still grieving intensely after 6 months, then it's pathological, you know, obviously. And some people get medication much, much sooner than that, much, much sooner. In fact, that's an epidemic in this country as well. I'm feeling really badly. Give me some pill. And so, you know, some people wait 2 weeks, 3 weeks. In many countries, they will never give you a pill for that.
No.
You know, they'll say, no, this is a natural course and you have to let it go and do not interrupt it.
And
this is why we're talking about grieving well today. We want you to grieve well.
And some cultures actually, you know, have you wear a band. You know, you can wear a band that says that you're in mourning,
sure.
that lets the world know and says, you know, let's chill. Let's support this person through their process. And they can, you know, wear that up to a year. And that makes more sense to me because, I mean, what are you supposed to do? Like you said before, grief is kind of your experience of the love that you have for someone. It's like that love has nowhere to go now. And it takes a while to turn that ship around.
Yes.
And to integrate again, like just the quality and the capacity of the love that you had for someone who you've lost.
Yes.
And that you had for, you know, maybe a sort of quality feeling that you had in life before all this happened. And I just wanted to speak to something around, you know, like the desire of this country to get back on its feet again. I get it. I know people have to pay their bills and we have to, you know, get things moving again. But there's potentially a quality of like, you know, it's like that thing. It's like you have 2 weeks off when your parent dies and then you got to get back to work. Like,
you
have to
get
over it. You know, it's like, get over it.
I know in some countries they give you a year.
Exactly.
They give you a full year to grieve the loss of a parent.
Yeah.
And it returns to the point, and I don't want to belabor America in this aspect. Of course, we have our issues with this, and we're not, you know, trying to denigrate America about this.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you mentioned your parents and losing a parent. I mean, to me, that takes a lifetime in itself to get over. So even though, you know, the medical community and the psychiatric community will pathologize grief after 6 months, you know, to me, living this life, losing a parent, loving or hating them and never loving and getting along with them is still the loss of somebody who was very important to you when you were young, very important to you. And your feeling life began and was created and formed in that atmosphere. So losing a parent is sort of losing that. So I get the idea that grief could be a lifelong experience. But today we want to talk about grief as something to allow yourself and then to also experience and to get through.
So, Kevin, I was wondering if you would demonstrate. You have a wonderful kind of meditation that you help people with to experience grief. To help, if it's something that you really haven't experienced, you don't quite know how to experience, how might somebody, you know, allow a quality of grief in their body?
Well, that's something I do want to demonstrate. I'm not ready to do it right now because, you know, I'd like to, because many people can't even identify their own grief. They don't even know they're in grief. I do, as a mental health professional, can see it and know it. But we want to talk about first how you know. I mean, sometimes you can see it on other people, but you can't see it in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're weeping a lot, if you're weeping watching television, let's say, and tears are coming in this period when they weren't coming before, you know, that would be a sign that you might be in mourning. If you're not talking to people, if you're keeping your exchanges with people very short, if you're craving isolation, craving it, I mean, you're trying to retreat back to some safe place. I mean, if you're agitated a lot, you know, there's a chance that you're grieving and you feel lonely and you're missing. Let's use that word. Am I missing something? What's missing? I'm not myself. Something's missing.
You might say things to yourself like, I'm so sad, like why even bother? Like why even try?
Well,
you might be feeling a real lack of motivation.
That's a definite deeper level of grief. And when it gets to that, you know, then you're entering kind of despair. And so you have to watch for depressive symptoms like, am I sleeping a lot? Am I eating? Has my eating changed? Do I eat less? Do I not want to eat at all? You know, am I contracted and it's like I don't feel like being energetic at all? I'm fatigued all the time. So now you're talking about, you know, clinical symptoms, Nasima, but you know, usual grief. Your shoulders are drooping. What do other people say about you? If you could ask somebody else, how do you see me? Do you notice a change in me?
Maybe the light will be less in your eyes. Like there can be kind of a dullness, you know, just a loss of yourself there. Like you're not forward in your body. You're sort of back. You're sort of holding back. You're down. You're in.
A sense of not being useful or of not being... having agency, like nothing's worth trying. So now we're getting into the deeper aspects of grief.
Yeah.
But, you know, there are physical ones. You feel weak a lot. You're tired often. You have headaches even. You know, you're certain sounds, you're reactive. Like your senses are more acute. You're getting images, flashes, like PTSD, right? You're getting startled by certain images and things. This is a good sign that, you know, you might be on a level of grief. Your system is grieving. So there's a physical aspect to grief. To me, the drooping shoulders, you know, the downward eyes, the downward cast of eyes. And again, these are not permitted in our country. You know, this is not, in some ways, it takes courage to allow yourself to grieve and to be in mourning.
And to let yourself be sort of held or hold yourself in it, that there is no need to push through it, to make it go faster, to make it, you know, happen quicker. It's just going to happen the way it happens. And if we can keep some sort of curiosity and space within ourselves to feel it, it will ease and it will have a perspective and a context, as opposed to being an overwhelming thing or something you put at bay, or that you're like, I'm just going to, like, for a week, I'm just going to cry and then I'll be done. You might cry for the week, absolutely, but you'll probably continue to have tears and emotions as we go. And just, again, something I want to sort of bring this to, like, this situation right now, even though we may not know it, there is... You know, I'm sure many of those things that you listed, people are experiencing. They'll be like, well, why am I feeling that when I haven't really lost anyone that I know? But we've lost a lot more in this experience. We've been losing a lot. You know, if you've lost a job, if you've lost, you know, some
your
income,
regular way of doing things,
your way
I mean,
of doing
you've lost
things.
Your structure. You've lost your schedule. You've lost your routine. You've lost your sense of normalcy.
Yes.
So even these, how are these making you feel in your life? How are you feeling? You're having a physical I know I am. Mm-hmm. I'm having a physical reaction to these experiences.
Yeah.
I'm constantly also trying to think of new ways to keep myself stimulated. I do not want to be heading back to bed in the middle of the day or, you know, being a passive recipient of information and movies and things. I want to be active, but I find that I could easily drift in the direction of turning my mind off and just mourning the loss. And that it would be nothing less than that. It'd be nothing more than that either. Mourning the loss of my schedule, mourning the sense of being productive.
Connected to others.
It's a good way to check in with your physical body, see how that's reacting to all of this and registering that as a loss, as this is loss. You know, it made me think, you know, grieving is a private thing. Music can really put you there, can put you in a connection. I Erik Satie is another composer that can really help you with the mourning process, grieving process.
That song, Vincent.
Yes, but that's with lyrics. But, you know, instrumentals are really... Mm-hmm. For me, you know, but yes, of course. right.
And there are some songs that totally get me. Yeah. And they're important. You know, I think the process, the understanding of grief can come through in music in so many ways.
Yes, it can. And, you know, a grief shared is a grief halved. Imagine if your whole family could grieve together, if you sat down together as a family. No words, no confusion, no rationality, no defense mechanisms. No, just that we could be together and grieve and put on some music and grieve. If you have 10 kids and it's a grief is 9/10 gone, or at least theoretically. But we went into the music with me saying good morning. You know, Nisima, I think really mornings can be good. Tomorrow morning, that is, the morning, if you grieve well. Yeah. And it's mornings can be difficult if you don't grieve well. So there's a purpose to grieving. There's a process to grieving. There's a usefulness to grieving. Grieving can really make you happier, much, much happier. It's holding back tears that really make you miserable.
You know, it kind of makes you frozen, I think. If yes. You have to freeze a part of yourself to not grieve. And I think sometimes the process of opening up and allowing grief allows a little more flow in your body, in your life, in other emotions, because a lot of emotions can be tied up in grief.
Yes.
And if you can start to melt that a little bit, let it unfreeze.
So I don't have like the method for doing it. I know what works for me. And so I'm just going to pass that along to you folks. And you can all devise your own. One is that I have clients do after a breakup or something, you know, that they've been holding on to, is I have them lie on the edge of the couch and lie on the edge of the couch and stretch out their arms as wide as they can and open their chest. And so it you know, it's the opposite of the contraction that mourning and grieving can do. Grieving and mourning can be a kind of contraction. And so for some people, it's right there, that the mourning is right there. So I just say, just get on the edge of the couch, or if you're at home, on the edge of your bed. You know, one leg is on the bed and one half of your body is on the bed and the other half is off the bed. And you're stretching your arms out as wide as you can and opening up your chest and making a sound.
Whatever sound comes.
Whatever sound comes. Whatever sound. Because there's a sound that's trapped in your chest and in your body. And it might just be right there. And that's the quick way. That's the safe way at home. One way I recommend to people. And another way is sit on the edge of your chair. You know, some people think, oh, for me to really be sad, I have to lean back and be really relaxed. No, sit forward in your chair. Sit on the edge of your chair. You know, slope your shoulders. Droop your shoulders. Let your shoulders drop. And close your eyes and you know, let your head drop. And feel your chest and feel your throat. What's going on in your throat? Feel that feeling in the throat. Because often, you know, when we want to cry, we feel it mostly in our throat. We feel it there first. So is anything going on in your throat? Just feel your throat and then feel your belly. See your belly and see the air go into your belly. And notice if there's any tension in your body. And just pay attention to the inside of your body, your throat, your chest, and your belly. And breathe. And see if a sound wants to come out of that. What sound is there?
And you might have the word missing in your head.
Mm.
What's missing? Who's missing? Mm.
Or loss. What have I lost? I've lost something.
It had to go.
Yeah. So those are, you know, so, and these take time, you know. I mean, some days there might be more there than others, some moments more than others. But even doing it when it's not there, I recommend for people to do it, especially if somebody, they've, you know, somebody passed away recently, that they do it for 30 days and do it 3 times a day.
Yeah.
At least for 5 minutes. That's right. Lie on your bed for 5 minutes, one leg on the floor. Open your arms as wide as you can and your chest and listen, see if there's a sound that wants to come out. And spend 5 minutes, even if you, you know, you don't want to give it that time. You can, after giving it a couple of minutes, you can lie on the bed fully. But do it for 5 minutes, and then also sitting on the edge of your chair and giving yourself permission to feel whatever's in your body. You know, tears are just trapped energy in the body. And as Frankie once said, you know, one of our therapists here came on the show and said, you know, nothing grows without water. Mm-hmm. You know, so tears, and Armand D'Amelio used to say, tears are the sweat of the heart. Mm-hmm. So, and tears, you know, release, hormones. They release endorphins and oxytocin. And so these are the good emotions, good hormones. So 5 minutes both ways, 3 times a day.
Well, that second position sounds so much. Well, actually, both positions sound like positions of surrender.
Yes.
There's a quality of surrender. Like there was nothing you could do to stop this death from happening. Or this loss from happening. There was nothing we could do to stop this pandemic. And it's here. Mm. And there's a quality of needing to surrender. And that might be difficult for some. And I think these positions are both really wonderful ways to explore that quality of surrender. And like, how does it feel to surrender? And there might be, you know, anger, sadness, you know, all kinds of stuff.
You know,
or
you,
even joy.
Yes, you know, and I think you're helping me add to this. You know, when you close your eyes and you're sitting on the edge of your seat, mm-hmm. you could say, you know, bring up the images of this person that you've lost, or the animal for some people, you know, they've lost their pet or some form of loss, whatever the grief is.
Your job,
bring
your
up
life.
The image mm-hmm. of you being happy with that person. See you. See that person. See. Your eyes are closed, your head is down, your shoulders are drooped, your breathing is open. And bring back all you can, all the happy times, the good times, the celebratory times with this person. Because really what we're saying is, what is the world losing? What has the world lost now that John is gone? Or Mary, or, you know, Michelle? Or what is, you know, because they embody qualities that are... You know, beautiful, beautiful qualities, not just experiences you've had with them, but their essence, their qualities. And if you can bring that to you while you're sitting on the edge of your chair or when you're stretched out on the bed and really saturate yourself with all of the positive images, you know, you can go deeper into the sadness.
And even like feeling into maybe... Like, those wonderful qualities of these people, but what they brought out in you.
That's another one. That's great.
And you might be feeling like, I will never have that again because this person is gone, but that's not true. You do have that quality.
Well, hold on a second.
That
maybe...
person's, you know, sparked a certain quality in you.
Yes.
And you can still claim that. You can still claim maybe the joy or the way that you were with them.
Yes.
You still have that. You can still be that
okay.
way. But
I mean, you're adding a dimension to this, which is right. I liked me around that person. I liked who they brought out in me. And I'm missing part of me mm-hmm. with them gone.
Yeah.
And who can I get that back with? How can I go on bringing that quality out in myself without this person there? You bring out a really good... And maybe not, Nassima. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure you can get that back. That's what's missing. There it is. That's what's missing. The me that I was with that person, I'm not going to see again. And what a kind of mourning that is. Right? I mean, let's just be with that.
Yeah,
just be
I hear
with
what
that.
You're saying.
Okay. I just really, I think for the audience, it's important. Just be with that idea. That's mourning. That's loss, and I'm not going to get that back. And that's okay.
And that's like a reflection of the love that you had. Like, that's that thing that where how much you're grieving is how much you loved.
Exactly.
And that can apply also to like a job or, again, like your way of life, your structure, like how you were in your life. Maybe it was great. Maybe it wasn't so great. Maybe you're getting an opportunity now to have some perspective. Maybe you lost a job that you actually didn't like so much.
Yes.
And you have some time to sort of reflect on where, you know, how do I want my job to be? How do I want my life to be? What can I do now? Or you can be like, wow, that's a job I really loved. I really want to get back to it. I hope I can.
Well, it's certainly a time of reimagining and revisioning, you know, and letting things go that might not have worked. I think, you know, people are finding a great reason to not return to certain work and to really say, well, what do I want to do with the rest of my time? This is an unprecedented amount of time that people are having to themselves, by themselves. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's important to reach out, and many people are learning that skill of reaching out. But it's a chance also to say, wait a second, I can feel my life now in a way I haven't felt for so long for many, many reasons, that maybe, you know, with the amount of time I have left, I don't want to go back to that kind of relationship or that kind of job, that kind of activity, those kinds of people, that kind of behavior. There's, you know, so we're framing it as loss, and a lot of it is loss, and we're not going to, you know, drop that as the idea of what's going on, because we're talking about grief and a pandemic and a tragedy and a calamity in many, many ways. But it is giving people an unprecedented amount of time to get in touch with themselves and revision and reimagine their lives and really register. Because, you know, especially in this city, you know, you don't have time to register the impact of my commute on me, the people jostling me on the subway, me rushing up and down stairways and into and out of stores and, you know, into and out of meetings and things. We're not registering these things. And now we're in an unprecedented time where people are doing that. But I did want to return to this idea of a measure of love. That, yes, that was a measure of love and life that these losses remind us of, that how alive they made me feel. And I might not get that back with another human being, with another job or something, but I think we really mourn the loss of human beings more than anything. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a measure of how well I'm living, how much life I have by my absorption and love for another human being, and now one that's possibly gone. Which, you know, I wanted to talk before the end of our show about the stages of grief, because it makes sense that you would get angry, and it would make sense that you would deny that this is going on. That part of me that person brought out in me is, I'm not going to lose that. I'm never going to lose that. That's not gone with that human being. It is gone. But you deny it. You need to deny it for a little while. And then you need to get angry at it and say, okay, when I'm angry now, well, I'm starting to surrender, like you said, that's what this is. Ultimately, when you grieve, you surrender. But first, you're denying it, and next, you're angry. Okay, so I'm just going to go through the rest of these, because, yes, it's natural to deny, and then it's natural to get angry. And then what happens as it deepens, as something else happens, the anger starts to recede, what happens? You bargain. You know, you bargain to who? You know, to life. Some people bargain with God or, you know, the universe or something else. But, you know, my anger is waning a little bit, but you know, I don't want to lose this, so I'll change. I'll do something different. I'll be another way. I'll be a better me. Just don't take this from me.
So bargaining is it's such an interesting stage to be in. It can be a very frustrating stage for the people around you, because they might be able to see that you're kind of bargaining with God and trying to do everything you can to stay alive or to want to bring somebody back from the brink.
So it's kind of irrational?
It can be irrational, very irrational, because it's trying to prevent the process.
Right.
There's something happening. And these stages are pretty much connected with terminal illness, people going through a terminal illness. And
so if you're getting a bad diagnosis, if you're getting a diagnosis,
yeah,
that's right. I have heard that about.
So that's where they really observed these stages. But I kind of feel like it applies to many other situations with different big changes or big transformations in life.
Okay.
But this quality of bargaining is a very frustrating one. And it can be a difficult time because it's a time when the person is kind of trying to rally to keep things the way they were when they are obviously changing.
It strikes me as a time of magical thinking.
Yeah.
You know, you almost, if I do this, then please, you know, and who are we talking to?
Yeah.
You know, who are we fooling?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, again, it's something universal. They're doing this across cultures, across the world. It's a common phenomena that these five stages of grief go on. And these first three, denial, then anger, then bargaining, and then what?
Depression. So it's kind of like realizing. So, okay, so the magical dream has become reality. And the reality is, you know, this is it. This is the way things are going to be. This is what's happening. And that can set up a big depression. Like, well, then why would I even want to continue? You know, what time I have left? Or, you know, I don't want to necessarily put this in terms of terminal illness when we're talking about this pandemic, but there is a quality of like, wow, you know, we aren't going to be able to interact with each other the way we did before. On some level, there's always going to be a little paranoia about coming into a big crowd, about being around other people, having a dinner party. It's going to be a while before that drops.
Yes.
And that's depressing on a deep level. Like, wow, you know, we're going to be watching sports that have no crowds. And, you know, things are just so different and it can be very depressing. It's like, this is the change that's happening. We need to be able to
I want to say something about that as well. But before I do, I want to just recap because I'm thinking, and you're the body expert, you're the body trauma specialist, but almost imagine this as a body thing that your body fights. First of all, this fight and flight, right? Somebody's going to die. I got a bad diagnosis. I got a diagnosis, terminal diagnosis. First is denial. My head takes over. I'm not going to accept this. Then my parasympathetic nervous system gets activated and I get really, really angry. Or not my parasympathetic.
Or sympathetic.
My nervous system takes over. And then I get really angry and my emotions start to fight. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, my mind gets back and activated or my heart and I start bargaining. And I want to make sense of this, and please take it away from me if you can. Mm-hmm. And then depression is like, well, none of that is working and is going to work. You know, I drop my shoulders, drop my head, and I'm depressed.
Yeah.
And then what? So you go through periods of this, like weeks, months, in some cases years. And then what?
Well, then there's the opportunity to come to acceptance. And that's a real spiritual sort of transformation of all this energy that has been sort of condensing and convulsing in your system. And somewhere an alignment happens. And you just come to this place of acceptance. Or I would almost say surrender, like to bring that word back.
Okay.
There's a quality of, I'm going to stop fighting this. I'm going to be with it as it is, day by day. This is it.
Right.
I'm going to be realistic with myself. It doesn't mean I have no joy. It doesn't mean, you know, it's like I can start to move again. I'm not caught up in this. And to, you know, it's like I'm going to move however I move. Each stage is each stage. And just try to be with it and be with myself. And hopefully others will be in the same page with me.
There's a breath again.
But my own personal experience with this came through the passing of my mother. And it took me a while to get to the stage of acceptance. I went through a lot of denial, bargaining, some depression, a lot of bargaining.
How about anger?
I know. I was bargaining with her a lot. Anger didn't quite hit until later.
Okay.
But I'm sure it was there because I know my mom was in the stage of acceptance long before I was. Many members of my family were in the stage of acceptance before I was. When I finally did surrender and realize what was really going on and sort of came out of my denial, when I finally was able to get, you know, in connection with my family on that, then the process became a really precious one. And I think that's what acceptance can sort of give this whole process. And I feel like maybe in this time of, you know, the pandemic, we have like months still to go until life. And I'm curious if there's more of a quality of acceptance in this. Like, okay, we've already been through 35, 40 days of quarantine.
Yes.
Okay. We know how to do this now. And here we go into another 35, 40 days.
Yeah, we should have a national day of acceptance.
Right.
Maybe, okay, right? We've been through a war. We've been through denial. We've been through anger. We've been through bargaining. Probably,
I think we're in bargaining right now.
Well, we did do the blaming, right? I mean, the anger blaming stage. So we're in the bargaining stage. I don't know.
Trying to get our lives
and
back.
And then the depression stage, maybe when we register the full toll that this has taken on all of us. But we should have a national day of acceptance. What a great word, acceptance. You know, we're coming to the end of the show, Nassim, and I wanted to say something about how this is going to change. You mentioned something about how when we all come back together, how things are going to be changed. Are we going to be paranoid? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I tend to think we're all humanity, we're evolving, and we're evolving in a positive direction. Life itself is good. And so we have something to start with, and that we're evolving no matter what. You have been listening to The Positive Mind. I am Kevin O'Donohue. Thank you for tuning in. If you have any comments about today's show, please send them to me at kevin@thepositivemind.com. That's kevin@thepositivemind.com.